May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jim Bailey. I represent Gordon Blakey, who is husband. He is the respondent below, and he is the appellant in this case. Mr. Blakey seeks, at its core, a fair division of property and an award of maintenance which he can afford to pay. He seeks consideration in this case of the facts which have been presented to the trial court, but he seeks a consideration which is reasoned and which is thought out, which leads me to the first issue that we want to talk about. In this case, it's undisputed that the trial court adopted almost without change Weiss' proposed findings of fact. And in and of itself, we clearly recognize that that is not an abuse of discretion. But what it does lead to is a critical review and a critical scrutiny of those findings as we progress forward through the case. And that's important as we look at the underlying issues here, because it's our position that these findings cannot withstand a critical review. There's an issue which we tendered in our opening brief. It's the Emerson House. Trial court found that Emerson was going to be sold. We've stipulated to that. That issue is not before this court. But it still is indicative of the care that the trial court exercised in this case. The trial court found a stipulation or an agreement to sell Emerson when no such stipulation and no such agreement occurred. And what we're suggesting is that is indicative of the care or the scrutiny which was exercised in this case. There are more troubling things that we need to talk about. One of those relates to the sufficiency of the findings on the overall property division. I recognize that generally the sufficiency of the findings can be a generally open concept. It must merely provide a clear understanding of the grounds for the trial court's order. And the trial court must present or articulate how it considered those factors. In this case, the trial court did not consider those factors. There are several clear factors which are missing. There is no stipulation concerning value. There is no stipulation concerning allocation. There is no stipulation concerning division. We recognize that in this case, both parties requested that the trial court have an equal division, but that does not solve the property issues. More importantly, in this case, husband raised separate property contribution claims. That is, he brought separate property into this marriage, which became marital. That's a factor that the trial court must consider in its allocation or division of the property. No such consideration occurred in this case. There's also some very troubling issues that relate to the valuation of the marital businesses. The court undoubtedly recalls that husband is a general contractor. He had a heyday during the economic boom, which ended abruptly in 2009. And at that time, husband's income basically plummeted. All parties agree that at the time of permanent orders, his income was essentially zero. With his businesses and with the plummeting of those businesses, there's a series of litigation that was raised in the trial court and which are an issue going forward and in fact still exist. There is the Moskowitz note receivable. We recognize that there is evidence in the record that that note receivable would be worth $100,000. But between the time of the valuation, that's Mr. Vincent's report, it's Exhibit 39, and it's the basis of the trial court's finding. And the ultimate permanent orders in this case, which happens in April of 2013, Moskowitz initiated litigation against the parties in this case.
Counsel, was any effort made to either update, amend, or otherwise correct the expert valuation by either side?
The expert valuation was stipulated to be introduced into evidence. The Moskowitz litigation was actually, if that's what the correction is, was incurred after permanent orders. And so had it happened before permanent orders, we would have amended or altered the litigation. And here it's not necessarily the valuation of the escrow, which is our primary concern. It's the funding of the litigation that's associated with both the Moskowitz escrow, it's the Heald's litigation, and it's the, I think it's Skarajunsky litigation. Those three litigations remain pending, and I think at least one of them is against both parties. It's that debt that the trial court failed to allocate or divide between the parties.
Pardon me, counsel, I want to make sure that I understand your argument. and if I'm wrong, please, please correct me. We have a litigation that occurs after permanent orders, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So it would be impossible for the court to consider that at the time of permanent orders, or am I wrong?
I believe that it's possible for the court to consider it because it's raised in the closing arguments. It's a very difficult thing when we had this. Do we go back in and do we attempt to reopen permanent orders? Do we wait for permanent orders to enter and then modify because of the subsequent fact? And the decision was made is to alert the court to the existence of the Moskowitz litigation. The Heels and the Skarjanski litigation was in fact pending at the time of permanent orders. And so that the court was aware of the necessity of reserving jurisdiction over those two as it entered permanent orders. And in this case, the trial court did not even address this potential contingent liability and these contingent obligations. There has been a suggestion from Wife in this case that the trial court has two choices. It can value or reserve jurisdiction. And here the trial court did neither of those two. There's no value expressed in the record, and there is no reservation of jurisdiction. And that results in a division of property which is unconscionable because of the contingent nature of this debt. There's been a suggestion that the parties, or the trial court, I think, even found a stipulation to divide the property in this case equally. Debt is negative property. And if there's a division of property that must be equal, there must also be a division of debt which is equal. There is one opportunity which may have to be raised, which is under 16.2, there's the possibility of going in and seeking an amendment because of a subsequent material fact which wasn't known at the time of litigation. The trial court has the ability for 5 years to come back and to look at it's called non-disclosed assets, and here would be a non-disclosed liability. Also, a primary concern for husband is the maintenance award of this case. At the time of permanent orders, husband had, in essence, no income. He was working on odd jobs. He was attempting to earn a living. The trial court, and there's a key word here, imputed income to husband at $20,000 a month. The trial court expressed the basis for this imputation. The trial court found that the $20,000 per month was based upon a reasonable estimate of husband's average historic earnings. There's two difficulties that raises in this case. One is the trial court made no finding that husband was voluntarily under or unemployed. That finding is required, it's expressed. Wife has raised several cases in this case. One of them is the Martin case, the other one is the Brieger case. Both of those cases talk about imputation of income where there is a finding of voluntary underemployment. And it's good to distinguish the two of them. In Brieger, there was a finding, an express finding of voluntary underemployment. In Martin, there was not. And the Martin case was, in fact, remanded to have a determination of that.
Is that what you're asking for here?
Well, we are asking that the entire permanent orders are reversed and remanded. And
that I understand that, but I'm talking about this particular issue. Is that what you want done on this, is to be remanded for the court to look at this imputation question so it can determine whether it should or should not make such findings?
I believe that is one of the aspects that we're seeking.
Okay.
Primarily what we want here is a determination of husband's income. For example, if in fact there's been, wife has suggested average, that the trial court averaged husband's income in this case, and the trial court never used the words average. We don't believe that either an average is appropriate because we never captured the downside. We're only capturing the upside here. And we also believe that it's inappropriate to impute income because husband is doing his best under the facts and circumstances that exist in this case. And the difficulty that this presents becomes manifest as we take a look at the maintenance obligation. In this case, the trial court entered lump sum maintenance. Lump sum maintenance is disfavored. There has to be a special circumstance to justify that award of lump sum maintenance. In this case, we tender, there's no special circumstance. The only circumstance that's been suggested, one is from the trial court, And the trial court says that lump sum maintenance is appropriate because of the cyclical nature of husband's income. And there is no cycle or cyclical nature of husband's income. In truth, the reason for lump sum maintenance is expressed by wife in her briefing. It's because husband can't afford to pay the core maintenance obligation. It's the only mechanism that wife could have when she tendered the findings to the court that would result in an income stream to her was to take it out of the property that had been allocated to husband. That's not what Colorado law says. The case is In Re Marriage of Gray, and Gray says you can't generally pay for maintenance with property. And we all heard the word generally. There are exceptions to this rule, but an exception cannot be that you can't afford to pay maintenance and therefore property is okay. Because under those circumstances, the exception will consume the general rule. In this case, because of that, we're in essence having a disproportionate division of property, and there's no justification or finding to support that. And we have a maintenance award that husband cannot pay out of his income. The trial court also failed to consider the appropriate statutory factors as it went through the maintenance obligation in this case. It is clear that as we're doing that, there's no reasoned consideration of each of those elements. Instead, it is purely a number which is based off of husband's income and a historic lifestyle. And we admit that the party's lifestyle was good, but that lifestyle was funded with capital. It's the same way that husband's income was funded with capital. And when we divided the marital estate, husband now lacks the ability to build the house to get the income from it, because that is now being consumed.
Counsel, may I ask you a question? In opening statement during the permanent orders hearing, wasn't it in fact Mr. Blakey's suggestion through counsel that $5,000 a month for 5 years was an appropriate amount?
No, Your Honor. I did say that in the opening statement. If you look in the sentence that immediately follows that, I correct the trial court. My client corrected me and said that is an incorrect. I stood up, I asked the trial court, did I in fact say this? The trial court recognized that I said it. So I misspoke and we did correct the record.
All right, it's not in the next sentence. I see it's later in the opening statement.
So yes, Your Honor, I did say that.
So you amended it to 500 a month for 5 years.
That's correct, Your Honor. Finally, there is an issue concerning attorney's fees in this case. In this case, attorney's fees were allocated as debt. Case law is clear that that's improper and that's an abuse of discretion. That's the In Re Marriage of Burford case, and we are therefore requesting that attorney's fees be set aside. At its core, this entire permanent orders must be reversed and it must be remanded. The property division sets aside each of the other divisions in this case. Maintenance and property are inextricably interwoven. Maintenance and child support are inextricably interwoven. So we are requesting that this case be remanded with appropriate instructions. I'd like to reserve the balance of my time.
Of course.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Frank McGuane. The firm is McGuane and Hogan. My associate, Holly Tabrizi, to whom I attribute the good qualities of our brief to. If there's anything not good, I'll take responsibility for that. I'm not going to stand up here and sort of regurgitate what we put in the brief, because I think we've addressed the issues pretty well, at least from my standpoint. What I'd like to do is to highlight a couple things. If the court has some questions, I'd be happy to entertain those. But my guess is that I will not need to use my entire 15 minutes of time. A couple things I would like to address, though, Your Honors, is first of all on this issue of the voluntary unemployment. I don't believe it was ever Ms. Lucero Blakey's position at trial that Mr. Blakey was voluntarily underemployed or that he was shirking or anything like that. The argument was, and I think the evidence supported that, that the nature of his business was such that he built high-end houses up in the Eagle Valley. It often took several years to turn those into cash. And when they did that, then they They paid debts and did other things, made a couple of investments, the Tarson investment and the Gilbert, I always want to say Gilbert and Sullivan, but whatever the Gilbert investment was. So there was money not only for them to have a high standard of living, but also to make some significant investments and to acquire real estate, which in turn put the total value of the marital estate, or something, using Mr. Blakey's numbers, something in excess of $1 million. I can't remember what the exact number was, but...
Mr. McGuane, yes, pardon me for interrupting you, I'm sorry, but I want to make sure I understand what you've just said. Is it your position that you do not think that husband was voluntarily underemployed in this case?
That's the position we took at trial, Your Honor, or the position that we did not take at trial. We were saying that he was in the construction business, and it's up and down, and that he was still in that business at the time of trial. He didn't have any big jobs, apparently, at that time. It wasn't that he was unemployed. I think by his own testimony, he had a few jobs that were ongoing, not big things, but things that kept some money coming in. So it's not as if he were in a position where he just didn't have anything to do.
So understanding that, could you explain to me how you get to the point of how it's legally appropriate to impute income to him? Okay.
Well, I'm not even sure that we're talking about imputing income. Maybe we are, but the way I would look at it would be that the history is that his because of the nature of his work, that his income has been up and down, and that the expectation would be that would continue in the future, that there will be high periods and low periods, just as there have been in the past. I mean, these folks have been together for the marriage, I think, was 14 years, and I believe the evidence was that they'd been together for some, maybe a relatively short period of time even prior to that, but he had been in the construction business during all that time, and there had been the ups and the downs, but, is it equitable just to take a snapshot as of the day of the trial and say, well, right now, he's in a slow period because of economic circumstances or other circumstances? Or is it not appropriate to do that? And keeping in mind the nature of the economy and the state of the economy and the state of construction and that sort of thing, notwithstanding where that was during, let's say, the 5 years prior to trial, the parties were able to, and Mr. Blakey was able to, complete construction projects, I mean, to the tune of several millions of dollars to maintain the lifestyle of the parties, to allow them to have a nice home as they had in the past, and to make a couple of investments that were something in the nature of $500,000 between the two of them. That's the Tarson and the Gilbert investment.
Counsel, but how does the record substantiate the trial court's conclusion that he should be assigned an annualized salary of $240,000 a year, where their tax records, at least for the years that were provided, would only substantiate something less than half of that. So what evidence supports the trial court's conclusion such that we can affirm it?
Well, and I think that's a good question, Your Honor. The tax returns, as I think is true of tax returns generally, don't always tell the picture, the complete picture. Mr. Bailey, in his opening brief, I believe, mentioned that in 1 year the income from the business was $96,000. I think that was, he said that it was the capital gain was $96,000. Well, the capital gain doesn't tell us anything, because what the parties were doing, they were funding these projects during the course of the marriage with expenses that were going to then be deductible when they filed the tax return when they get the money. So. This was all money that had been marital money that was during the marriage that was used to pay those expenses, which in turn brought down the total number to a capital gain of $96,000. So I would just submit that the tax returns don't show the true picture. And the other part of it is that the tax returns only went back a few years, I think maybe 3 years prior to the trial. And for one reason or another, Mr. Blakey, you know, apparently chose not to attempt to get those returns. They would have been available, should have been available at least back 7 years from the IRS. So,
well, fair enough. But how do we get to $240,000 a year?
Well, I'm not sure exactly what the total analysis was, Your Honor. It was probably based on a total of about $20,000 a month that the parties seem to be spending when you combine their standard of living and the lifestyle that they were maintaining and the investments that they were putting money into over and above that. If you look at the debt service just on the real estate, I believe the debt service on the three parcels of real estate was in excess of $10,000 a month by itself. So there had to be money to pay those expenses. There was never any indication that any of those expenses were or those mortgages were in arrears. There was never any suggestion that because of the need to make those payments on the mortgages that the party's lifestyle was depleted. So piecing all those things together, and admittedly, a lot of it was circumstantial evidence. But the court has to do that, you know, and these are tough cases, and especially somebody like Mr. Blakey, who was in the business that he was in. And the key here, I think, Your Honors, is that in this entire case is credibility. Judge Moorhead, who this court has probably seen some of his cases, and from that I would think one could conclude that he was a very thoughtful, conscientious, hardworking judge. Not in any way a slacker or somebody who would just, you know, take the findings that were submitted by one of the parties and just sign off on them. He's just, you know, his reputation and I think his record is to the contrary. But the key is that each of the parties had a theory of their case, and they had certain approaches that they were presenting to the judge to try to sell their theory of the case to the judge. Well, it's obvious that Judge Moorhead bought Ms. Lucero Blakey's theory of the case and did not buy Mr. Blakey's theory of the case. And that's reflected, I think, in the orders that the court had. Now, the unfortunate thing, I guess, in a way, is that Judge Moorhead is now retired. So if the case has to go back at all for anything, that could be problematic, and it may end up that even though probably several hundred thousand dollars have already been spent in attorney fees, that, you know, we're going to have to start all over again. And I hope that that's not going to be necessary. But moving on, if I may, I'd like to address the issue of attorney fees, because that's one that I think is a little bit tricky. And until you get in and look at the Burford case, you could get the idea that the court was wrong in saying that the legal fees on both sides should be paid off the top from the assets. But if you look at Burford and look at what and I think it was the Court of Appeals opinion on Burford that was cited by Mr. Bailey and really addresses this issue, is that Ms. Burford, Ann Burford, who some of you may know, I think she's deceased now, her position was that Mr. Burford should pay all or part of her attorney fees. Instead, the court ordered that all the attorney fees, and I think made some of Mr. Burford's, I'm not positive on this, but at least some of Mr. Burford's attorney fees were actually incurred during the marriage but related to some of his separate property. But in any event, she was asking for Mr. Burford to pay her attorney fees. She objected to the order by the court to have the attorney fees paid off the top, because she said that's contrary to 119. Section 119 of the dissolution statute, you know, says that the purpose of an attorney fee award is to equalize the financial playing field, shall we say. But in this case, it is not Ms. Lucero Blakey who was asking Mr. Blakey to pay any portion of her attorney fees. It was her proposal to take the attorney fees of both sides off the top. So if anybody's kind of losing on that, she would be the one where the judge found that Mr. Blakey's income was $240,000 a year, But instead of saying, Mr. Blakey ought to pay all or part of my attorney fees because he's got this high income and I have little or nothing in the way of income, she said, take it all off the top. So I would just submit that the Burford case and the rationale behind that really does not apply in this case. If it had been the opposite, if Miss Lucero Blakey was asking Mr. Blakey to pay her attorney fees, then we would have the Burford situation. We don't have that here. And I think, again, Judge Moorhead very thoughtfully figured that this was a fair way to do it, to treat these expenses as an expense of the partnership. They come out of the sale of the assets, so they're not coming out of Mr. Blakey's income. They come directly out of the liquidation of the assets, which had already been agreed to by the parties and ordered by the court. I'm running out of time here. I'm taking more than I thought I would, but I want to address real quickly the issue of the maintenance. Judge Moorhead said how he got to the $3,750 a month in maintenance, but that doesn't mean that the maintenance was actually $5,000 instead of $3,750. The maintenance was $3,750. He showed us how he got there, but what he was doing was taking advantage of the provision of Section 71 of the Internal Revenue Code, which says that the parties can agree or the court can order that maintenance be non-taxable to the recipient party and not deductible by the payor. So that was that's certainly permissible according to the law. What Judge Moorhead was apparently trying to do was to just to simplify this whole process, do a 25% discount off the $5,000 a month. You know, let's say 20% round numbers for federal and 5% for state. So that we didn't have any tax issues. Now, is that kind of an arbitrary analysis? Sure, but it's a very reasonable one, taking into consideration all of the circumstances. So I think what Judge Moorhead was trying to do was to, he recognized that these folks could hardly agree on what day of the week it was, and that it was important to try to come up with an order that was hopefully going to put a rest to all their disagreements and that sort of thing. And he did the best he could under all the circumstances, but obviously didn't accomplish that objective or we wouldn't be here today, I guess. Let me quickly see if there's anything else. On the issue of the business debts, the Moskowitz debts, the debt that Mr. Bailey was referring to, Mr. Blakey actually told Mr. Vincent, the CPA, the neutral joint evaluator, that he thought that debt was collectible, and he was in the process of, and I think this is in the record, he was in the process of trying to collect that because there's actually $100,000 in an escrow account, and I believe it's still there, as far as I know, and so Mr. Moskowitz was apparently trying to get some of that money, so he made some kind of a counterclaim against Mr. Blakey. But Mr. Blakey himself, and this is in the record, told Mr. Vincent that he thought the $100,000 was collectible. And I think based on that, the court was certainly, within its discretion and it was within the evidence for the court to come to that kind of a conclusion. I believe that's all I have, Your Honor. If you have any questions, I'm happy to entertain those. Otherwise, I'll waive the rest of my time.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Bailey, you've got about a minute 45.
I want to thank you for the table, by the way, on behalf of all of us.
Several points I think require clarification. I will actually do this in reverse order. Mr. McGuane was speaking of the business debts. There's actually four things that we're talking about under that general rubric. We have litigation, which is Sarjunsky, Healds, and Moskowitz. The fourth concept is the question of the escrow, which is the $100,000, which was presented to Mr. Vincent. With respect to attorney's fees, I don't believe that Burford can be read in the way that's suggested by Mr. McGuane. Very specifically, as you look at that case, it says it's inappropriate to consider attorney's fees as debts because they're governed by different considerations. And you can't mix and match when it comes to attorney's fees and when it comes to the property considerations. But the primary focus here relates to the income issues, which I will touch upon again. One is the trial court imputed income. It's said twice. And if that was not sought and there's no evidence to support that, then we're entitled to an order which reverses the finding of Mr. Blakey's income without more. The trial court was very expressed that it was imputing income and was very expressed as to the basis of that. And even Mr. McGuane, when he spoke with you just several minutes ago, said that basis. Historic doesn't count. Things change. We have to look at the present circumstances. We must consider those circumstances at the time the parties present themselves to the court. Things may change. We recognize that, but there is a mechanism for that change. Lump sum maintenance precludes that change. It's non-modifiable, and therefore it's an abuse. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both, counsel, for your arguments today. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.